Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Dug Too Deep, the officially unofficial podcast for the Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power on Amazon Prime. I'm Jim.
I'm Arondir.
Oh no. Do I have to call you that? Because that'll be very confusing. Okay.
No, but I was pleasantly surprised there's an Aron in Middle Earth, and he's a badass gray elf, man. Elf warden, ranger, something.
Is that somewhere between like elf and dark elf? I'm getting my fantasy bearings here. You can't drop gray elf on me and expect me to know what the hell
it is. Yeah. Well, I mean, I barely know, and only because the Lorehound's excellent elf primer, but there's like varieties of elves that are largely differentiated by whether they've heeded the call of the Valinor to go to whatever the land of Valar, and whether they made it and where they stayed. Anyway, these are the ones, the elves that I think they're called the gray elves, because they didn't go to the Undying Lands. They were never exposed to that beautiful warm light that Galadriel and everybody goes crazy about. They're really, really big on light therapy, those elves.
Yeah. It helps.
It's huge seasonal affective disorder. Yeah. They those trees go down and just like, they got to go to war. What'd you think? I'm dying. What did you think? Cause you're like, I was worried about what I would think, but I was super worried about what you would think, because holy, I'm a lot more attuned to this kind of fantasy bullshit wavelength. What'd you think?
Yeah, it was a lot, but I was pleasantly surprised, because it wasn't as much as I expected, honestly. And maybe it was because I knew the name Galadriel already.
That was your wooby. You just clung to Galadriel.
Yep, and the first episode focuses quite a bit on her, so that was nice. It brought me some familiarity there.
You cling to Galadriel the way Lex cling to Unix in Jurassic Park.
Oh.
This is Galadriel. Yeah. I know this. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Shut down the trees. reboot the trees. Is that a thing you can do?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. See, it's fantasy. It's all new to me.
The Valar spared no expense on those trees, let me tell you.
And Amazon spared no expense on this show, because, I mean, literally, they didn't. They spent almost $500 million just on production. I've heard it.
So the latest thing I read this morning was $1 billion, because they spent $250 million on the rights alone. Uh-huh. And then I guess $500 million on making the first season, and then I think the other $250 million must be in the marketing, because I know you've seen the marketing; it's been everywhere.
Yeah, I saw it at the movie theater, which is a rarity.
Like a trailer, just a full on trailer, like not in the Maria Munoz bullshit section, like in the big boy. This is a trailer section.
Yeah, and I think it paid off. I mean, it's on the screen, man. I will say, I don't think I've ever seen a show look better than this show does. Even House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones, all that stuff, I think is like a notch below what you can do with $500 million pumped into a single season of television.
Especially if you're talking beauty, because like, I think House of the Dragons is no slouch in the visual department. And there's even some, like, I was just noticing, like, just open windows behind Viserys and seeing the narrow sea and the sun shining on King's Landing. Like, it's there is some moments of color, and like your heart kind of lifts, but it's every other scene. Like, everything is so beautiful and colorful and just otherworldly.
Yeah, no, it really feels like you're in that world. In a way that other shows, occasionally you see the cracks. Like, you get a dragon riding scene in House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones, you're going to see the cracks. This doesn't have any cracks, as best I can tell. Everything looked completely real. And so I was drawn in by that. And I think the story, you know, as much as I'm afraid of fantasy stories because they often just deal in huge sweeping archetypes of characters who have no real personal stakes in anything because the stakes are so high, they necessarily apply to everyone. I think there are some interesting, like more grounded, lower stakes stuff in this episode, and I appreciated that. And it's I guess, like, when I say I'm pleasantly surprised, that's the thing. I expected to go into this having to be like, oh Jesus, okay, ignore that. All right, this person's name is just Elf Ears 2, and this person's name is Elf Ears 3. Knife ears, whatever.
We're gonna we're gonna use slurs in this podcast. Holy shit, cover your ears.
But I
your leaf shaped your beautiful leaf shaped majestic elven ears.
But I was definitely surprised by how much the personal stakes felt real in this too. So I ended up enjoying it quite a bit.
Yeah, I'd started to kind of be afraid of this project because I've said as much, not very much, because I try not to shit on something preemptively. This is a perfect example why. But those last two trailers I thought were pretty rough. Like, I thought, like, man, they really leaned into the, you know, like the high fantasy of it all. And that's what I was worried about. I was like, you know, this is great because I like that. You know, big sweeping badass gothic, you know, these night beasts tearing into griffins and smashing to the grounds. But like, if that's all it is, it can feel very kind of hollow. And like you said, I was really pleasantly surprised that they gave us like some simple things to ground ourselves with: a sister avenging her beloved brother, an elf who has you know, a strained friendship with the dwarf, and now that's going to be crucial to rely on.
Might be a spoiler.
Is it?
It is that happens in episode 2, right?
Oh shit! You're right.
For future posterity,
fuck it. If this is going to spoil the episode for you, then fuck it. But like, yeah, no, you two friends with a strained relationship, a girl coming of age. Feeling torn between some of the ideals of her people as far as like keeping to themselves and keeping hitting, and other ideals of her people being open-handed and charitable and helping fellow beings out. And that's like, you know, that's kind of why there's a love story. I know some people, some people kind of get all feeling a certain way when they have these, you know, no one liked the Hobbit elf romance in The Hobbit. But I thought
this one feels done pretty well. I thought, like,
yeah,
the extra tension of like these people were once like loyalists of the big bad. Morgoth, I don't know the actual name. I think that's super interesting. I think that adds a layer to it that complicates it in a compelling way.
Yeah, I'm glad. Speaking of the Morgoth of it all, I'm glad we have the Lorehounds with us, because that's one thing I was afraid of when I thought we would get screeners for both this and House of the Dragon. That, like, man, how am I going to keep these big? Because I'm not a slouch when it comes to Tolkien lore, but like, you know, John is on a whole other level over there at Dave with the Lorehounds. And yeah. I was like, it was such a relief that like, I don't have to look up all this shit. I don't have to know the differences. I can just wait until John tells me about it on Monday. And I asked him last night, I said, because like I listened to the Lorehounds, excellent primer podcasts. And, you know, I've read the Silmarillion in high school. I've read the Tolkien appendixes as recently as 10 years ago. And I was thinking like, man, it feels like they're playing a little bit of jazz here in the timelines, and especially like some of that first day. And I honestly don't know where we're at in time as far as like, you know, where the Numenoreans are and whether they've already had it feels like they're playing a little fast and loose. But I feel like, and I think John agreed, that the spirit, the feeling that you get when you're reading the Silmarillion, when you're reading, you know, the Lord of the Rings, that soaring fantasy and possible stakes, but also grounded in like, you know, Sam and Frodo loving each other. They're nailing that feeling of the huge sweeping fantasy, but also it's going to rely on, you know, people and people stories. That's going to make the big things happen.
Yeah, I love that. The other thing that really felt like Lord of the Rings to me is those, not quite Hobbit scenes, the Harfoots.
Yeah, the Harfoots.
As soon as they came on the screen and they were dancing around and chomping berries, and I'm like, man, this feels like that first, chunk of Lord of the Rings, right? You've got the evil that has to be vanquished and that is vanquished, and then the war continues on, and then you go over to this pleasant village, this little encampment. Yeah. Of these Harfoots, and it felt alive in the same way that Lord of the Rings did when I first saw that. So yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by both the tone, the execution of the effects and the storylines and all of it. I really liked it.
Yeah. Again, I was coming in. I was extremely nervous when this thing kicked off because I'm like, man, what if this is just goofy? You know, because like maybe I'll like some of it, but then like Jim's going to really, and like I don't want to be on 8 episodes shitting on this show, and like it's going to be awkward. But like
I was so scared. Yeah. I was just going to be like, oh, I don't care about any of this. But
yeah,
it turns out I do care about it.
Yeah, no, and I watched him twice. The first time I just didn't take any notes. I just kind of let the show wash over me. And there was like one or two things that I kind of didn't care for. There was a Galadriel sword vaulting that was very reminiscent of Legolas shield surfing down the staircase, where it's like, okay, I get it. Elves, they're amazing. But also, this kind of looks a little hokey. But that was like the only that moment. And there's like maybe one other where I thought there was some awkward stuff. But like I said, the original, the Holy Trilogy, Jackson's had a couple moments where kind of goofy too. Tolkien has some moments where shit's just kind of goofy. But it's about as good as that adaptation of an appendix of the Lord of, again, all of this is, they don't have the rights to the Silmarillion. They don't have the right. It's like only the things that are touched on in these fairly lengthy appendixes, but it's kind of amazing. Like there's like a sentence or two in the appendix that they're like spinning whole episodes of lore about, like that, this thing about the elves guarding the men of Morgoth. Like I thought that was, it's essentially based on a line about the elves really holding a grudge coming out of that first age of how they'll never forget the men that sided against them in the war against the great enemy. And now it's like, yeah, they got watchtowers and they got a whole order of people. It's very kind of Game of Thrones warden, you know, the watchers on the wall. And it's not canon, but it's a really smart expansion that makes a lot of sense and adds a lot of color and drama to the world. I got to give it up to the Amazon Studios. Seeing the first two episodes of House of Dragon, I'm like, well, I don't know what the Rings of Power are going to look like, but there's no fucking way they're probably going to be as good as this.
Yeah.
And I watched this episode and like, I'm having a hard time stating which won the first two episode contest because they're so different too.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, House of Dragon is more my flavor of television show. I think like the political intrigue that's going on there is more exciting to me.
There's a little bit more realism, grounded, you know, again, dragons and all. But
I think this actually does a better job of creating a world and putting you in it. Honestly, I was thoroughly impressed. I like I said, I have never seen something look and feel as much like it's supposed to as this show does.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the other thing. Like, I haven't seen Wheel of Time, but I did watch like the first 15 minutes of an episode, and I watched a lot of like trailers, and you know, that's certainly goofy in a way that this show is not. And yeah. I think that's I think it's a huge win that the Rings of Power are just having us kind of debating whether they're as good as the House of the Dragons. Because again, it's really different. It's like, which do you like more, a fucking two-handed broadsword, or do you like a rapier? It's like they're both kind of effective. They can both be beautiful and well made. They can both take a head off, and that's what I feel like you're comparing here. You know. And it's, you know, grim darkness versus noble brightness, you know.
And we'll probably be talking a lot more about that based on these first couple of episodes. By the way, I should say we've seen two episodes. This is the podcast only for the first episode. We're going to try not to spoil too much, but it might be tricky because I've seen these in the last like 12 hours. I've slept for six and watched these for the rest of the time. So
I know. I'm about 1-to-1 sleep to ring of power ratio yes. right now. So
we'll see if I can keep the spoilers non-spoilery. But yeah, we'll be talking about episode 2 in another podcast here in just a bit. So
I also have, I was also wrestling with just a huge sty in my left eye. I was over a couple villages over grazing on some grass, know, and now I got these swellings, these boils. I'm not sure what's going on at that, but we'll see if I can soldier on.
Yeah. I can't make a joke about milking you. All right, let's start off this podcast for real and get into the recap, shall we?
Yes, please.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. All right, we start off with young elves playing in a field, and one of them, Galadriel, makes a paper boat and sails it. The other kids destroy it with rocks. Her brother explains to her the difference between boats and rocks, which... Okay, I'm playing a little fast and loose with the description here, but that's essentially this first scene, and we'll get to the voiceover and all that stuff here in a second. But it definitely is setting up like a light versus dark theme, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like literally in Tolkien's world, literally, you know, the good people mm-hmm. are associated with light and the evil people are associated with stealing light and replacing it with darkness.
Yes.
It's the was that the Interstellar that's got the quote about the No, that's the same guy. It's Russ Cole's got the quote about, you know, some people look up this night sky and they see the pinpricks of light and they see that the darkness is winning, but like in the beginning there was nothing but darkness, so the light's actually, you know, is actually making a comeback. I felt very much like that. And this is just, I mean, this is the Elves' Garden of Eden. I think it was kind of like immediately moving, talking about these people who don't even have a word for death because they thought our joys would be endless. And although I thought it was interesting to put just little shitty elf mm-hmm. children in the Garden of Eden, you know, like you fuckers are going to eat the apple. You might have let Morgoth steal the light. You're trying to bully little Galadriel in the Garden of Eden. What the hell's wrong with you kids?
Yeah, that sucked. I thought there was more. I thought they were more in sync, those elves, even when they were children. But I guess not. I guess there's a little strife there, too.
No, apparently some elves are some petty bitches. Arendir's friend was pretty, non-elf-like in some of his counsel and sayings, too. True. And you know, elves can be a little arch, but I thought they really sold the cleverness and spunk of the young Galadriel, like really setting her up. If you're familiar with the more stately Galadriel from the films, like it feels like they're going to tell a clear progression of how she starts off here and she goes through hell to get to her end.
And we're about to kind of yada yada past a lot for her, I think, in this voiceover, but we'll get there in a second.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say I am shocked at how good the show looked. Again, I want to reiterate that I've never been more happy to own a 4K TV. I swear,
dude.
I swear, Amazon is streaming this at a higher bit rate than their other shows. And if they're smart, that's exactly what they're doing. Stream this at 80 megabits a second. Whatever my internet connection will do, stream it at that.
Not only did they stream it, but I think that Bezos came in last night and replaced my television with an 8K setup because I saw that moment of her brother Farrandir. I don't have his name handy.
Yeah.
But when they're walking over the hill and you see the light of the trees and the kingdom of the elves, and it's just, I saw that shot in the trailer. I knew it was coming, but like it's a fucking moment, man. And it mm-hmm. is just so gorgeous. You're gonna hear me say that so many times too. Yeah,
I know, it's crazy how much they impress me with the visuals. His name, by the way, I don't know it either, but it's much stupider than Farrandir. It's like I can't even think of a stupid term that would be stupid enough.
Farfagnugan.
Sure. So here's a little pet peeve of mine.
Yeah,
that I'm glad the episode didn't lean as hard as I expected into. And this has happened in several shows that I've been watching. This happened in a Westworld episode recently. This happened in a Better Call Saul episode recently. Now it's happening here where a character will be having a conversation with someone and that we can hear it and we are acknowledging it, we're following it, and then suddenly they lean in, they whisper something that we are not privy to. In a lot of these shows, they just don't give you that information. They never give you that information. Like, what did they say? Why? What is the purpose of leaving me out of the loop of this part of the conversation? And it's really a pet peeve of mine now. I'm happy to see that by the end of the episode, they have corrected that problem. So we do actually get what she said, what he said to her.
I started to get annoyed, but I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to delve really hot into the mysteries of this show, like any more than just like a, you know, above average boned up on the Lord of the Rings fan. But even then I was gratified to see by the end of the episode, they just let you know. And I thought it worked well, you know, like a really nice bookend for this pilot episode that, you know, it's got its own little arc.
Yeah. This is a lot about Galadriel in this episode, and that mm-hmm. really worked for me too. Oh, let me ask you this. Find out later that I think is what they're implying and saying here, that Galadriel as a child was living in the Undying Lands.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where we are in this first scene?
Yeah, this is okay. Valinor.
Valinor. I don't know how to say it. They say it a few times in this episode.
Yeah, the Undying Lands, where elves go when they have expired on Middle Earth, or when their cares become too heavy. Where you essentially can live in perfect health and bliss until the breaking of the world. And who knows what happens then?
Yeah. Sounds good. Let's get to the voiceover and the montage here. The voiceover explains that the elves thought their light would never dim, but then Morgoth. I really need to know if it's an O or an A. It's killing me.
It's Morgoth.
Morgoth. Okay. Destroyed the Tree of Light and started a war with the elves, which raged for hundreds of years in Middle Earth. Galadriel's brother was killed in his quest to find and eliminate Morgoth's most devoted acolyte, Sauron, and Galadriel took up his quest.
Yeah, I mean, they cover like a couple thousand years of history, I think, in this.
It's a long time.
Feels like it, too. Oh, his brother, mm-hmm. brother's name's Lindor, like the truffle people.
Lindor?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
He's full of strawberry truffle filling, it turns out.
Lindor from Linden?
Lindor from Linden. That's the thing. Is like if you knew Sindarin and Quenya well, these like are all based on root words and whatnot. So it's like
of course,
yeah. So but I thought this whole montage of the elves at war, where you see the tree getting destroyed and the elves are like, fuck this, we're not taking this lying down, we're drawing our swords. And then the crash to this, like these griffins fighting dark beasts, you got these orcs and the elves, and there's a shot of this beautiful city by the sea that's got all these spires, and it's being down thrown in flames and ruin, and there's elves corpses floating in the water with spears. It's just, I mentioned on the instant take that the Lorehounds did last night that it felt like the shit that really gets my blood going in Warhammer, like this kind of like crazy gothic shit of primeval forces moving in copper, almost Lovecraftian. And the difference being that in Warhammer, everything is grim, dark, and shit always breaks bad. And the Lord of the Rings universe, it's the noble bright, where it's like things can get super grim, but eventually the good guys will always win. Perhaps spoilers, the world doesn't end in this movie, and Galadriel and Elrond make it through. I don't know. Maybe they'll kill him. Shit, that'd be wild. That'd really get the lore purist pissed off. But yeah, no, I think it's that the things are going to work out even if you get pressed through the precipice. I love this shit. I love it when things look like a heavy metal art cover, album cover.
Sure.
I love that particular flavor of fantasy.
Yeah. I thought it was cool. I was happy to see that the orcs looked like orcs. I can immediately identify, oh, that's an orc. I recognize that. Mm-hmm. So they haven't like totally gone in a different direction from the Lord of the Rings visually. I'd say if anything, they just took that ball and ran with it and just enhanced everything. Made it look,
I was surprised
better.
Sauron looks very like, yeah, they are definitely looking to the movies for their style guide. Like, yeah. Sauron looks like Sauron. The elf cities look like elf cities recognizably. Mm-hmm. They're very the Rivendell and Lothlorien, which is smart. I don't think boy, there's a lot of money spent, a lot of talent in creating that look, and I don't know why you abandon it. They didn't. And in fact, they just essentially take that as a base and just expand. And mm-hmm. I thought that was really wise choices.
All right. Next up, Galadriel takes her armies treacherously far north in the search for Sauron. In a cave on a mountain, they find the mark of Sauron. She wants to continue north, however, not having seen an orc for years and thinking the mark was very old, her army decides to lay down their swords and return home, and she apparently follows them, at least temporarily.
yeah, I thought that was ambiguous, but you know, they resolved it. Mm-hmm. And I like her that she's like maybe uniquely lost more. Maybe she's lost, you know, since she's one of the oldest elves, maybe she just has lost more. And I got the idea that these elves following her are necessarily younger, lesser elves than her. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's the whole thing is like, I can't stop and enjoy any possible fruits of peace until I know this can never happen again. Yeah. Which is
a fool's errand. I mean, unprovable quest. Yeah. Let's say that. I mean, that's the thing. You cannot prove that your enemy doesn't exist. The best you could prove is that they do exist. But the search would just go on forever if Sauron just disappeared, right? Like, what is the evidence that would convince her, oh, Sauron's gone forever?
Right, right. And I think it's more vengeance, and it's more like trauma-driven hypervigilance on top of vengeance. And it's keeping her from living her life, you know? Uh-huh. She might as well be dead because she won't be happy until... Because it feels like that's the only where this ends, at her dying. If she gives her life in this quest, then it will finally be enough. And she says as much.
And I like what Elrond says later to that. You know, like the only place you're going to be able to heal what's broken in you is Valinor.
Yeah. See, only in the Undying Lands will you get, get the piece you're looking for, which she hilariously rejects. I really like this elf ninja getup that they're wearing, too. It's very reminiscent of like Zelda Twilight Princess. Okay. Mm-hmm. Isn't it Zelda that goes around dressed in some kind of ninja getup? Like, I thought it may have the silver mail with the stars emblazoned on it was really cool and warrior-esque. I like the Mark of Sauron. I'm not sure if that's a piece of lore, because Sauron's usually got the, although this Mark of Sauron might be like a stylized cat's eye. I wasn't quite sure, but like it's a big old MacGuffin, you know, it's a big old thing that's going to drive a lot of these quests to try to find where Sauron's holding up. And
yeah, it's a marker for the orcs to follow so they can follow them, too.
Yeah.
A key piece of information here I think you need to take note of is this place is so evil that torches give off no warmth. I think that's important going forward, and we'll talk about why later.
This is true. It also ties back to the ring where Gandalf threw it in the fire, but then dropped it in Frodo's hand and said, don't worry, it's cool. It's quite cool to the touch. Yeah, they're definitely shading some stuff in there. And I guess we got to stop and do this every fucking scene, but this is, again, gorgeous. Like, them walking on this dark, lightning-lit, snow-driven plane, and then the lightning barely illuminates these grotesque thrones and towers, and you realize it's this... I just love a fantasy series where a person can say with a straight face, the light gives off no warmth because the Mount of Evil... Like, it's just like, it's cool, man. It's cool. I wish we lived in a world where you could tell when things were really evil just based on how cold you felt. It'd be a lot easier. It'd be a lot easier to navigate the world, you know?
Right? And I don't know. This is where, like, I bristle against sort of some of the fantasy level stuff that's happening here, where... you know, unseen forces and indescribable powers and all that sort of stuff. Like, that doesn't sit well with me, but as long as they're going to be consistent with that stuff, and I'm hopeful based on these first two episodes that they will, because I think they're using very specific details to tell you things. And as long as those details remain consistent, I think I'll be okay.
Did you catch that Bear McCreary did the score for this show?
I did.
I was super impressed because I've liked his music. You know, I think he's done better. You know, he kind of rises to the show's occasion. I was skeptical that he could get to this gear. Mm-hmm. But man, when they revealed those, like I said, grotesque thrones and fortifications, and you hit this like creepy, evil choral music, I'm like, damn, Bear's knocking it out of the park.
Yeah. Yeah. He's been with Bald Move from the beginning.
Pretty much.
As far as our coverage goes, so it's good to see him growing. Yeah.
I did not know. I mean, this is a palette that I've never seen him paint with before.
Mm-hmm. All right, then we get a late title card, and there's no theme in this episode. There will be one next episode. It seems like a pattern with shows just like showing you a logo now in the first episode and getting right to it. I'm fine with that.
We didn't talk about the big fight, the snow troll fight.
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty cool. I don't know how I feel about like Galadriel. Like these elves felt like they were just completely outclassed by the snow troll. And then Galadriel just shows up and single-handedly kills them by vaulting off this one douchebag's blade. Well, yeah. That's the you know, Legolas shield surfing moment of the episode. I feel like I was expecting it to, because like elves are like these fucking badasses. I mean, you've seen Legolas, like, you know, you kind of can walk away with thinking he's worth 10 of the other fellows. And I was like, oh, man, it's going to be cool, because this is just going to be a smoother, more more efficient version of the pell-mell fight that we saw in the Fellowship with the Fellowship and the cave troll. But it's not. It's like all the elves are getting their asses kicked, and then Galadriel comes and handles the guy. I was a little underwhelmed by it, but literally this is the only thing in the episode, I think, that even mildly perturbed me.
Interesting. I was not underwhelmed by it. I thought it was cool. I didn't. Let me say this controversial opinion, I think.
Okay.
If the shield surfing looked better, I would not have cared one bit that he surfed a shield. I think that's a cool idea. I know a lot of people don't like it for two reasons. A, it looked like garbage. Like his fucking head is shifting around. Like the CG just wasn't there for that at the time.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, a lot of people don't like that he does it at all. And I'm like, I don't know. Little. I saw him like surf down the trunk of an elephant, a giant elephant. Like, why is that any different than surfing his shield down the stairs?
I couldn't explain it, but it is.
Is like, it just
one
was
a little one is a little X Games Tony Hawk, and the other was just like Legolas falling with style, you know?
Okay. All right. Fine. As soon as he pulls off that 1080, you'll be singing a different tune, let me tell you.
Yeah, when he gets his max air combo.
All right, some travelers walk through the Harfoot territory, and then we meet the Harfoots, who
the fucking map transition sequences, brilliant idea, because like it really gives you like this feeling of like where all the collision courses are coming, and they're gorgeous to look at too. They're the classic, you know, Tolkien maps, just like done all CGI and three-dimensional and zoomy. And
I like those. It's very like Indiana Jones, very honestly, it's very Game of Thrones intro sequence.
Like, it's interesting.
It felt like they were aping that a bit, but
yeah, especially on the week where Game of Thrones or House of Dragons, like, you know what? Fuck those title sequences. We're going with a fucked up family tree. And like, I feel like a little bit the Rings of Power is eating their lunch here.
But I also noticed that when they have maps out in the actual show, they look just like the drawings you would see in the Tolkien books, right?
Yeah. It's super cool.
Very cool.
Which I guess Christopher Tolkien did all those. Something I learned on the Lorehounds podcast.
Those illustrations was...
The maps in particular.
He would have been extremely young when he did those, right?
No, I think he was a man full grown when this stuff was published.
Gotcha. I don't know.
I didn't fuck that up. But I thought I heard that Christopher did those map illustrations.
Well, write to the Lorehounds and they can clear that up for you.
It's true.
Okay, now let's go over to the Harfoots. They seem to be at least Hobbit related. These aren't full-blown hobbits, right?
Like
proto hobbits.
So yeah, there is a couple like speculation of where the hobbits came from, because they kind of pop up in the third age and like, what the fuck are these halflings? What, you're not a dwarf, you're not a man, you're what are you? But it's from the perspective of the elves and men that these, I think, appendixes. And I love this, like, yeah, Harfoot, hairy feet, you can kind of like get it. They're like these primitive, rustic hobbits that their entire life is essentially a speakeasy. And that that explains why they kind of like, because like, who knows? They might have been around since the first age. They're just really good at hiding from the big folk. I thought that was like a really great way to smooth over that potential hitch from the lore of like, you know, we know when hobbits came and we know where they're from. So, yeah, you're supposed to understand that these are essentially, yeah, these are a little bit more rustic and a little bit more primitive and a lot more undiscovered. But they're essentially hobbits. They got hairy feet. They love their food. They love their drink. They love their festivals. They're not quite living underground yet, but they're living like a nomadic traveler type lifestyle.
Yeah, it's getting big. Station 11, what, traveling?
Yes.
What is
theater,
that
called? What was it? The traveling theater company? I couldn't remember either.
Big that vibes.
I got big Monster Hunter vibes from these hunters with the giant moose horns on their back. That was really cool, too.
That was, especially when you put it in perspective of this is where the Harfoots live. I don't know how dangerous the beasts that they took those off of are, but they're certainly massive.
Yeah.
Like, way more massive than a human's or than a man. So like, I would be scared if I were a Harfoot.
And also that the Harfoots are like these kind of legendary, scary, haunted people from the big, you know, because they're
he's
like just
bullshitting the guy, right?
He's is he? Because
I think so.
Because like I think one of the things that they come with the Lord of the Rings and appendixes is like Tolkien's like, you know, well, what? Okay, we had this world with elves, dwarves and hobbits. Where the hell are they all now? Mm-hmm. And he kind of explains like the elves are kind of fade away. And you do hear about the elves. That's why we have the fairy tales that we hear about. Like you walk down a forest and out of a glimpse of your eye, you see movement and you turn. And it's just a circle of toadstools and they're gone. It's because they've kind of melted into the margins. And you know, like you get the idea of watching the ancestors of the hobbits here that like these people could hang out in the forest of England now to this day. How the hell would you know? Because they're gonna just roll everything up like they're a speakeasy and Elliot Ness mm-hmm. is raiding them when you get close. Right. They can smell those big folk coming a mile away. I thought that was just really cool extension of the lore.
I also love how they like track the movements of men, like we track animals' migration patterns. They're tracking the men's migration patterns. I found that
there's levels to it, and I just the scene of them unrolling their entire life and down to the babies, where the baby comes out of blanket and instantly resumes his crying. I just thought that was really funny in a droll sort of way.
Yeah. There's, you know, kind of important stuff here. Like these proto hobbits, Harfoot, seem like they're having a good time, but they were very concerned about these travelers arriving out of season. And then we meet Eleanor, who goes by Nori, who's sneaking her friends into the old gardens to pick some berries, and they spot a scary looking track, and something spooks them in the background, and they make a hasty retreat.
Yeah, it's
this
very
just what so it- much fun.
It is. It's very Merry and Pippin running around in Farmer Maggot's crops.
Yes.
And then a lot of you, obviously, just like in the movies, a lot of the comic relief is going to come from these folk. And I really loved Nori and Poppy from the beginning. I thought their mm-hmm. dynamic was just perfect.
All right, let's move over to.
Are there blackberries this fucking big? Were these prop blackberries? Because like these are like fist sized berries. I was drooling watching them. I know they're small, but like in real life, these are normal sized people. So did they make prop berries
or
is there a variety of blackberry that's just this fucking big? Because man, it's like you have in the Bible story book, you always saw like when the Israelite spies went out and stole stuff from the land of Canaan and they brought it back. And it's like, yeah, the promised land grapes, and they're like the size of fucking softballs and like a watermelon the size of a cow. And they're like, look at all this. Look how good the stuff. Like, yeah, these are promised land berries, man.
Yeah. State fair berries.
State fair award winning berries. Mm-hmm. Every one of them.
Blue ribbon berries.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, let's move over to Elrond getting notified that Galadriel has returned to Linden. Is there a name for this city, or am I going to just use Linden as a catch-all?
I think it's Linden. Yeah,
the city is Linden. Okay, it's hard for me to tell sometimes what's a region and what is a city.
Yeah, because some of it is a city, some of it is a region, some of it is
yeah. Okay. I thought they say it's the capital of the High Elves. So
speaking of elves being pricks, I love how these ladies prance out to tell Elrond, "Teehee, you have been uninvited from the official thing because you're not an elf lord, loser." Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Okay, anything else? Oh yeah, your friend's here, loser." Like it felt unnecessarily cruel. Like this secret meeting, you're not attending. You've been unsummoned. Don't worry about it. It's elf lords only, boy.
Yeah, why was he summoned in the first place? He probably wasn't, right? So they're literally just here to tell him that he's not going to be summoned.
Yeah. Big little sister energy that these elves are given.
So he goes to see Galadriel, and she's concerned with getting an audience with the king so she can continue her quest. But he tells her, look, you're lucky that the king has not punished you for your quest. And he promises to get her an audience with the king after the ceremony.
Yeah, and they preface for the Undying Lands because they say that once you cross over, it's like you hear a song that you somehow have always known, and you feel a light more intoxicating than any sensation on earth. And this is, Elrond, who's never been I hope, like, that's the story they're telling. And mm-hmm. Galadriel, who is of old, you know, as you know, she grew up bathed in that light. It's an interesting dynamic, you know.
This is another familiar face, obviously, to me, Elrond.
Yeah.
Although his face is familiar, but maybe not for the reasons you would think. He looks more like Neil Patrick Harris than he does Agent Smith. Although,
yeah,
now that Neil Patrick Harris has been in The Matrix, I'm not sure there's much of a distinction.
It's true. They've crossed over into each other's territories many times.
Yeah. Getting strong.
But this is like big Doogie Howser elf lord.
Yes.
It's feelings from this guy.
And here is, like, you know, this is the scene where we find out that Galadriel actually came back, returned with her armies when they put their swords down. I was kind of surprised by that. I'm surprised she didn't just soldier on by herself.
Yeah. And I really like how they used the dagger as like a stand-in for her vow. You know, like her releasing her and taking and unsheathing. It's like her, like, you know, constantly thinking about that vow that she took, the vow of vengeance she swore.
Yeah. I didn't know there was even a king of the elves. This is how much I don't know about Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Gil-galad.
Gil-galad is his name? Okay.
Apparently, our producer says that you're right, that there is Linden is, yes, the capital, but it's divided into two pieces, north and south, and there's a mountain range that divides them. So you got North Linden, South Linden. Are there elf based gangs?
Yeah.
If you're a North Lindener and you're caught in South Linden, it's your ass.
And there's some serious dance offs happening on the edge, the border.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, again, I'm going to say this, like, this is so fucking beautiful. The establishing shot of this city and just how glowing everything looks. I thought it would get old, or it would get like, oh, this is too much. But like, nah, man, my eyes were just drinking it like it was a cool beverage and they were parched.
Yeah, for the first time ever, I have finally learned to appreciate the whatever the smoothing they do on modern televisions is. Mm-hmm. Because it switched over to HDR and my setup is not really like configured properly for HDR.
Yeah.
So I don't watch a lot of HDR stuff. Mm-hmm. But then I saw that it was doing the smoothing and I turned it off and I'm like, man, this just doesn't feel right. It's not scanning properly. And so I turned the smooth stuff back on, and by the end of this episode, I got used to it. And I would say it looks maybe even better. It's a little too canny.
Because I turn all that shit off because it gives that, they call it the soap opera effect.
Yeah,
you know, where it's like it's de-cinemifies it.
Yeah, I don't know if they did something to like counteract that a bit, but I stopped noticing it after a while. Maybe I just broke my brain in that particular way. And I'll never.
Why did you turn it on? Because you were noticing what was the HDR was not engaging correctly.
Yeah. So when you're watching certain types of content, and you have it, that smoothing stuff turned off and it's running at like 24 frames or whatever it is. When they're doing a pan across something, stuttery.
Yeah. Or blur. Yeah. Or sometimes blurry. Yeah.
That too. And so when you turn, you know, that stuff back on, it smooths all that out and it looks great. But that's why I did it.
All right.
Anyway, Nori returns to town and gives her dad a berry. And he tells her about the travelers that they saw. And then her mother scolds her for going to the old farm and tells her not to be so curious about the outside world because they survive by being together. And then Nori also leaves a berry for her mom.
Very Gandalf, you're far too inquisitive and curious for a Harfoot. She's like, I want to know where the rivers flow. I want to know where the birds get their song. Her mom's like, look, fool, we are little people and we stick together and that's how we stay safe. We stick to our paths. We stick to our corner and what more do you want? You got huge berries. You're going to get your ass kicked in if you go off for adventure.
They're developing themes here, right? Of like stronger together and community, all that stuff.
Yeah. and how they're like carefree. That this is, I think they're trying to draw a parallel between these people and their innocence and the elves and the before the First Age. That like, yeah, elves have their forest and men have their field and dwarves have their mines, but we just go like a leaf in the wind and we follow the gentle current of life like a river, and it's very, you know, in tune and free. Free. That's the big thing.
All right, Galadriel and her soldiers are honored with a ceremony and a trip to the Undying Lands of Valinor. Everyone is exceptionally happy except for Galadriel. That night, Elrond tries to congratulate her, but she frets over the premature end of her brother's quest and says she intends to refuse the king's honor and continue that quest. And Elrond convinces her to go by promising her that he will take up the quest if any of her fears prove true.
I thought it was interesting because, like, you know, the elves, like, hey, you're going to get to go to essentially elf heaven, and everyone's clapping. Elrond looks thrilled, and I'm like, elves are so weird because, like, I understand that you might be happy. Like, if you're a devout Christian, you might be happy that your friend is going to go to heaven, but also you're losing your friend. You know, like, they might be going into eternal bliss, but your ass is stuck here on Middle Earth, buddy, and you're never going to see him again. I felt it's so weird that there's not like even a twinge of like loss or sorrow, but like also they're playing Elrond like he's a very nakedly politically ambitious person, and you kind of get the idea that this speech is not so much Elrond speaking from his heart, but trusting the king that he knows better and he is doing right by his friend in the realm, even though Elrond maybe not sees the ends here.
Yeah, I think it's super interesting when paired with some other scenes. And there's questions I have because I have a very particular view of the elves based on the Lord of the Rings stuff that I've seen, which is just the movies, that they are pretty collaborative, pretty in tune with each other, and they're not looking to backstab anybody. This is not going to be House of Cards. But
yeah, I don't think Gil-galad is evil. I think he's doing what he thinks is right, but they're definitely manipulating Galadriel.
Yeah, and I see scenes here where I'm like, you know, is okay, I watch Elrond mouthing the words to the speech that the king's giving during this ceremony.
Because he was writing, did you get that he was writing that in the first scene we see him?
Okay. I wasn't sure if he had written that speech or if he had been through so many of these ceremonies and so enjoyed these ceremonies that he had memorized the speech that the king always gives. But yeah, it makes sense if he's writing the speech. And then there's like this hint of a thing where they might just be trying to get Galadriel out of the way, so they could declare this war over and move on from it, because she just won't let it drop. And their way of doing that is giving her this big ceremony, sending her to the Undying Lands.
Right.
Just to get her off the map because she's annoying them.
Well, there is that name. Like, there's definitely that's Tolkien is one of those mythologies where like names have power. And you know how like the elves would freak out when someone speaks the black speech in their presence. Like the idea that if you obsessively try to find Sauron, you might actually strengthen Sauron in this world. You might give him that tenuous tether to hold him to this plane of existence. So I think I mean, obviously they're doing the wrong thing, but I think that they think it's the right thing. Like I said, this isn't evil. It's they're like, you know, Galadriel's wounded and she's hurting and she's holding our people back, and she might be empowering Sauron for all we know. So we need to get her. We need to help her help us and decide to do it. I also really loved how
too deep, you'd say
she's digging a little too deep. I also really like the arc of Galadriel, because we see here at the beginning of her tests, you know, and she says, well, if I give up this, and she holds up her dagger, what am I to be? And it's very reminds me of the temptation, her last test, where Frodo tries to give her the Ring of Power and she's, I could become a Dark Queen. And she does her whole thing. But then at the end, she passes her test and says, nope, I'm going to diminish and remain Galadriel. Like the question of like, what am I to be if I don't have this quest, versus I know what I am, I know my worth, and I'm going to trust, you know, Elrond here essentially is going to ask her. It's like, look, you can leave, because if something bad happens, I will take up your thing, and I'm a capable elf, right? Mm-hmm. Like Galadriel clearly can't do that in this epoch of her life. She can't trust things to Elrond. Galadriel in Fellowship is going to be able to trust a hobbit of all things to to save the world. And I think that shows like it's really interesting to see where she's at thousands of years from now versus where she's at now. And I really like that through line.
Yeah. All right. I suppose let's go over to the Southlands, the lands of men, as they're described. An elf, Arondir, checks in on the men in a bar and hears a story about poisoned grass. One of the men gets angry about the elves keeping watch over them. And afterward, Arondir gets a gift from a woman, but their conversation is interrupted by the bartender. I'm not actually 100% sure they ever say her name in this entire episode. It's Bronwyn.
Bronwyn, yep.
For those playing along at home. Arondir joins back up with another elf who's noticed him taking a liking to Bronwyn and reminds him that that's a bad idea. And then they find out that their outpost is being disbanded and they're going home because the war is officially over. And then there's a little conversation with the Watchwarden, a little bigoted conversation where he warns Arondir that these people who once stood with Morgoth have not changed.
Yeah, that's the thing. That is the little uncomfortable current that runs through Tolkien's work is that, like, you know, people should just keep to themselves, their own class, their own types of people.
Oh, boy.
The greatest love story ever told, the two greatest love stories ever told is the dalliances between an elf and a man. But as, you know, whoever this guy points out, those often end in tragedy. You know, Arwen Aragorn and Arwen was one of the great love stories of the third and fourth age, but it ended in, you know, like what Elrond told her about, like, yeah, there'll be children and he'll be glory undimmed before blah, blah, blah. But after a couple hundred years, even his blood will run out and he's going to die. And then you're going to be left bereft and alone and with nothing. And the appendixes make it clear that's exactly what happens. Like, Arwen has, like, all these joys, all these centuries with Aragorn and her children. And then Aragorn gets to the end of his life and lays it down. And she's just bereft and goes to Lothlorien, where it's been abandoned. And she just dies under those trees, completely bereft and alone. Mm-hmm. So it's like, man, can an elf and a man love each other and not get fucking persecuted in this world? But on the other hand, it's also, these are different beings. It isn't quite like elves and men are not different. Like, races of men are different. You know, they're like literally one's immortal, one's not. They're made of different stuff. They have different afterlife fates. Like, it's, I guess, a little bit more understandable, but I always felt is a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, they'll reinforce that a little bit in the next episode too, which I really liked, but.
Sure.
Yeah, I agree. Like, and the idea that, like, these people, after so much time has passed, because these are men, right? They have, like, standard lifespans that we would think of as human lifespans.
Yeah.
And they've been at this outpost for 79 years. So anybody who was alive, and they've been tracking and fighting Sauron for hundreds of years. So,
and then they said this watchtower has been there for 1,000 years overlooking these poor people.
There you go. Anybody who would have been alive to support Morgoth has long since been dead. And if anything remains, it's a question, I think. Yeah. If anything remains,
it's more, I think, more like of the elves' trauma. And the fact that, like, 1,000 years is a good long time, but it's more like 10 years. And imagine, like, you know, what Americans' attitudes towards, like, Germans and Japanese were 10 years after World War II, what Americans' attitudes towards Vietnamese were, like, what Americans' attitudes towards Arabs are, you know, you can see that, like, from the men's perspective, this is fucking ridiculous. But from the elves' perspective, it's like, you fucking killed our trees. You fucking took all our shit from us. We didn't even know what death was until you threw in with this other fucker. Like, they are still worked up about it.
Yeah, this is the problem with a species or race or whatever they call them in the Tolkien universe that lives for so long compared to everybody else, is they will hold those grudges, I guess, against people who couldn't have possibly, you know, partaken or participated in those events. So they set off to Horton. Is it Horton? It can't be Horton.
I hear they heard a who.
I don't know. Maybe, it is. Maybe that's
I wrote this down.
Here.
I wrote this down. We haven't gotten to Hordern yet.
Okay. It's kind of surprising to me how quickly they spun off this love story between Arandir and Bronwyn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like it was. It wasn't done poorly. I think it was done as well as you can do it in this amount of time.
Yeah.
But we just kind of jump right into the middle of it, and it felt like too far along to be at the stage it was at. But I don't know. Maybe, you know, it's the racism or the bigotry and the...
Yeah, I think I feel you.
The taboo nature of it all. It just, something didn't feel right about where we started and how it progressed over the course of this episode.
I feel you. I think you're supposed to get the idea that, like, this guy has been fighting a war for 1,000 years. He's been serving in this tower for 80, and he's kind of numb. And you're supposed to get the idea that, like, these stolen moments at the well, there's been hundreds in the last 5 years or so. And this is the first time he's felt anything but, like, hatred and apathy. And now that he is being recalled and he might never see her, he's finding the courage to, like, put into words. And he even says, like, I've said this with every action and every glance for years, but I've never been able to articulate it. Probably because, like you said, the racism and the expectations and the fact that, like, mm-hmm. you know, he's probably uncomfortable with the fact that he's falling in love with one of these quote unquote evil people.
Yeah, but then there's a lot of, like, if you've been feeling this strongly for this long and having these encounters with this person,
yeah,
something about the way they interact didn't feel right. Something about the way that other people had noticed or not noticed didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. There was a just a timeline here that didn't make a ton of sense in my head, but maybe I'm just misinterpreting some things.
Oh, the only other thing I could maybe say to help you is that I also get the feeling that this has been very much under covers and under wraps, and it's this the inciting event of him being a little bit more open and doing things like leaving the tower alone and coming to see her alone has never happened before. And the men are starting to notice his carelessness because he knows he's going to have to leave, and he kind of, like, wants to do something, you know?
Gotcha. Yeah, let's talk about the scene. Bronwyn's son tells her about the rats under the floor, which will be important at some point. Arandir shows up at her home because he couldn't bear to leave her. And then another man shows up with a sick cow, and Arandir milks it, but something much worse than milk comes out. And he mentions that the cow was grazing east by Hordern. So Arandir and Bronwyn set off while her son goes to the barn and digs up a sword fragment from under the floorboards. And it has the same mark that was on Galadriel's brother and on, I don't know if it was an altar, whatever that thing was up in the cave.
And it takes him to the spirit world for a second or two, just like, you know, Frodo touching the ring. I thought that was really interesting. It seems like maybe starting of a possession going on here. Keep her eye on that. But this
is definitely the hilt of Sauron's sword, right? I mean,
gotta be
pretty obviously be. Visually.
I always thought he was a mace guy, but yeah, this is some kind of what you'd call a Morgul blade. This is a blade of pure evil, it looks like.
Yeah.
And I like the concept of, like, yeah, this, like, there's a sickness and a blight on the land. And if a living thing eats of it, it corrupts them too. And, like, yeah, just all this whole episode has been screaming. There is some bad shit happening down in these Southlands.
Yeah, I do wonder what caused it. Like, what is the inciting event here? Right. Because I don't think it's just that the sword is buried here, because there's a shot at the end of this episode where one of the leaves in Linden turns all diseased.
It's, you know? Blighted, yeah. So I think it's like it's a combination. It feels very much like Fellowship of the Rings, where it's like the Black Riders and Gandalf show up simultaneously, kind of looking for the right thing, the same thing. I think you're supposed to understand that these goblins, these orcs, have been tunneling under because they know they're looking for this thing. And they're trying to find it. And this boy, coincidentally, had Glint, he said, stepped in on an unlucky plank and he saw this thing, and he's bringing his slurth hurling teenage friend to kind of come look at it. And there's also tons of MacGuffins here. Like, why is this kid's father ran off? What happened to this family? What's going on? I wonder, like, how much of that's just background flavor or how much of that they're actually going to answer? Because, like, I kind of want to know who this kid is or who this kid's father is. You know, why did he have a blade of Sauron? Are the elves right in some way that some of these people are still bad dudes and carrying a torch?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I was getting more at, like, you know, why is there a blight on the land now? You know, what's happening now that is causing this? And I think maybe by the end of the episode we get a little bit to that point, but we'll see. All right, let's go over to Galadriel sailing towards Valinor. She's going to be doing this for a while, by the way. It's not incredibly weak, but I feel like the weakest parts of these first two episodes are the Galadriel parts from here on. I think.
Yeah.
Maybe not from here on, maybe from like a scene later. But man, they really sideline her in a super annoying way.
And it's goofy. I like this. This is where, like, to me, the noble bright gets, you know, because like on the Warhammer side, you like the grim darkness, but like sometimes it goes too far and they call it grim derp, where it's like, this is just stupid. Uh-huh. And like, I think that I don't know what the noble bright equivalent, the noble bork, where it's like, okay, you're standing in your goddamn silver armor with your fucking giant swords and cruciform poses, like you're about to sing.
Do I have to stand this way the whole time?
Yeah, like Hanlon's Messiah, and you're going to heaven, and like it's all this ritual, but it's like, I thought it kind of was good. I thought it was pretty goofy.
Yeah, I definitely did too. So she's sailing towards Valinor. Elrond's worrying about... or worrying aloud to the king if he's made the right decision, especially because they've foreseen things that seem to indicate she might have been right, but also that she might be causing some problems too with her quest. And the king invites Elrond to participate in a new grand project of Celebrimbor, the greatest elven smith.
Mm-hmm. With the funniest elven name.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bad name. There are a lot of bad names in this show. This is one of the worst. Celebrimbor.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are exactly two... I realized in this scene, there are exactly two hairstyles in elf culture. There's the long hair, and then there's the Steve from Stranger Things.
Yeah, you do. It's definitely not a lot of variety there. And the women's the same. Yeah. It's just how they braid. You know, they got fancier braids than the men.
Yeah.
Although the gray elves have sick fades. I got to say, Arendir is looking pretty goddamn sharp. The elf barber's done him upright. So yeah, there's the totally. Other. If you are an elf of the gray persuasion, you can get a sick ass fade. You got the Steve and the meatloaf.
I mean, that's just the utility cut you get out on the outpost, right?
Yeah.
I know
a lot
of barbers out there.
That's the warden. That's the warden cut. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go back to the Harfoots. Sadik, the wisest of the Harfoots, tells Nori that he sees something strange about the skies. In what is also a very funny scene, a fun, enjoyable scene.
Yeah, he's very another.
This is squirrel and all this.
The Sadik, I like this guy. He reminds me a lot of Gandalf and just the kind of his approach. And he's got these big tomes, and he's watching the skies and the stars. Yeah.
What would you call him in relation to this group? Is he just like the elder, the village?
It seems like it. Yeah. I don't know like what the family relationships are. Like, is this Dory's grandfather? Like, are they all like, is this a loose family group or what? But yeah, it does seem like if not their leader, he's their like spirit. He's the, you know who he is. He is, this is going to help you any, but, This is the old Deuteronomy of the Traveling Cats group. And if you've seen Cats the Musical, you instantly know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, you're more bewildered than ever. But, you know, that's your own fault. You've had 30 years to watch Cats. Get to it.
I'll go another 30 without watching it. It's fine.
I'll take it to my grave. Jim just swore an oath. He's got a dagger in his hand. He just made a blood oath to never watch Cats.
Come at me with a copy of that DVD of Cats. Come at me. I dare you.
Yeah, but baby, I got the 1994 cast recording. I got the fucked up one with naked Idris Elba Cats. I got all the Cats. I got more Cats than you can handle. It's my blood oath to make sure you see it. Who's going to win?
Dinch licking her own butthole. Yeah.
The Blu-ray discs of power is the new series that Bald Move just launched. Who will win the struggle?
All right. Let's go to Aaron Deere asking Bronwyn about the town she was born in, which was full of people who were strongly devoted to Morgoth, which sort of offends her, but they have bigger problems than bigotry. Horden has been burned to the ground.
Yeah, again, beautiful, this fucking establishing shot with the giant butter moon. I like the, you know, Aaron Deere's having to wrestle with the fact that he loves this woman and she is from evil stock, you know, like, oh, maybe your preconceptions about these people are wrong. I've got friends and close kin. They're good people. And also their village has been razed to the ground. That's, you know, you can feel sympathetic about that.
But as a viewer, I'm looking at this sword of Sauron and I'm thinking, well, why is that around her? You know, it's
sure.
That certainly seems very Morgothy to me, but what do I know? All right, we go back to the Sundering Sea, which Galadriel continues to sail on. Her armor is removed. The boat approaches the entrance to Valinor, but with her brother's words ringing in her ears and his sword or his dagger ringing on her belt, she changes her mind and jumps overboard with just the dagger. Simultaneously, a comet streaks through the sky, crashing down just outside the Harfoot camp. And a diseased leaf falls at the Elf King's feet. And the final scene here is Nori investigating the crater and finding a sleeping man surrounded by flames.
What did you think this crater resembled when seen from above?
Oh, you didn't get the
symbolism?
Now that you say it, is it the eye? The eye of Sauron?
The lidless eye wreathed in flame is what I got definitely from this guy. This is something that the Lorehounds have been debating, you know, like who is the Meteor Man? I guessed it was going to be Gandalf, even though that's wildly out of canon, his appearance in the world this easy. Because, I mean, how can you resist getting a Gandalf-like figure in there? I think they were going for one of the blue wizards, one of the wizards who is like the gray and the white and the brown. But, you know, we don't know very much about them. They kind of disappeared from the records. There's a lot of freestyling you could do there. And they might be right. But I'm getting big Sauron-type vibes from this guy.
Big time. And yeah. I've got and more we'll to talk. Say about that in the next episode.
Sure.
Yeah, big time.
I love how the meteor is something that connected all the plot lines. Like all the peoples of Middle Earth are seeing this. Oh my God, my heart sung so much when we saw Ents. There was Ents and Ent children running to an Ent wife that we've never seen before.
What version were you watching? I missed that entirely.
It's just a forest, and you'll notice the forest will start moving, and there's like a little Ent that runs to a bigger Ent, and like you know, that's like cool. Sees and he's scared of the meteor. Yeah, I was like, oh my God, there's fucking Ents. We might never see them again, but I never expected to see them at all. And this was fucking cool. Rock.
You're looking down at the ground. I'm the boat, baby. You got your eyes the boat, looking up at the sky, watching.
That's
the comet.
Right. And I thought it was really cool. I was like, what is her brother going to say that's not going to seem stupid? And I honestly say, how do you know you got the stars at night? They're reflected in the calm sea. Like, how do you know which are the real and which is the darkness? And he said, sometimes we don't know which light to follow until we have touched the darkness. And that gave her the confidence to be like, you know what? Fuck it. YOLO. I'm jumping in the literal darkness here and rejecting the light. Cause you can tell like this is an orgasmic experience for the other elves. This is like everything they've always wanted and never knew they did. And it's something that she knows, like, you know, like she's like, I miss this more than any of you guys. And she turns her back on it to clutch her dagger and fulfill her vow.
Yeah. Possibly dooming the entire land, depending on those, whatever, you know, Elrond and Elf King saw. I don't know his name.
And this is how you also, you know, that Gil-galad's not a bad guy, because he sees that leaf turned and he's not like, everything is going. He's like, oh shit. You know, like, this is bad. Yeah.
All right. That's the end of the episode. It's a good place.
It is
to
the
leave
end
it.
Of the episode.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. Of course, if you want to know more about the lore, because I asked John, the chief lore hound, what he would score on a score from like 1 to 10 on lore accuracy. He said a generous, I'll give it a generous 6. And he wasn't like from a place of like, this is bullshit. It's just like there, I did get the feeling that there was a lot of like faith to the spirit, but there was a definite like reordering and simplification of different things and simplifications of timelines to where, which, you know, fair enough. Like, I would rather them do that and lean into the characters and give me reasons about, like, and I do, like, I know, like, exactly why I should care about every one of the featured characters just going into the first episode. And that's pretty fucking crazy.
Yeah. And the only lore I give a shit about hasn't happened yet. It's the lore of the rings. So, yeah. They
yeah. Like, this is all about the rings of power. And we haven't even sniffed a hint of them yet. So,
right.
If you would like to send, so like I said, Monday, if you want to get a deep dive into lore, the Lorehounds are returning Monday to give their lore breakdown and discuss, you know, the Tolkien of it all and give their thoughts about the episode. And then we'll be back later on the week, I think Wednesday, for a feedback sesh. We will be having David and John from the Lorehounds join us to help us out on some of the trickier lore questions. If you would like to send in any of that stuff, please do so at dug2deep@baldmove.com is the email address that you'll be using to get in your feedback. dug2deep@baldmove.com. Of course, you can go to our Discord at discord.baldmove.com to follow along. There we got extensive threads, spoiler and non-spoiler. I'm really excited. Yeah, I'm so glad that this first two episodes of both these shows are strong and they're really bringing their A game. They're really taking it to us fantasy fans, and may the best series win.
Yeah.
We'll be back real soon for second episode. In fact, it's probably ready to drop by the time you're hearing this. Until then, I am Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya in a bit.